Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This has been a big month in paperback publishing. Among the New York Times' recent picks is The Cold Millions by Jess Walter. It follows two brothers, Gig and Rye Dolan, in the Pacific Northwest in 1909. They've been hopping trains in search of work. That fall, they arrive in Spokane, one of the region's biggest cities, a far better place than, say, Seattle, which is described this way in the book. Seattle was like an infection that started at the water and spread up the verdant hills. The smells of stewed harbor turned his guts. Salt flats, log pulp, and fish guts stirred by a tide that gently rocked the city's sewage back and forth. Spokane had its own problems. It was the site of a brewing fight between thousands of poor workers trying to organize for better wages and the few business magnates who control the town. And while the book is a work of fiction, it is based on some eye-popping facts and real-life events. Now, back in September, a panel of local librarians and booksellers awarded author Jess Walter the Washington State Book Award for Fiction. Walter, whose last novel was the bestseller Beautiful Ruins, grew up in Spokane and wrote for the local paper there. He joined me last year when The Cold Millions was published in hardback. I started by asking Jess what he wanted to capture about Spokane that the history books tend to leave out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point exactly. I think there are all these moments that just sort of get folded in the pages of history and we don't hear about them. And I was a reporter when I first uncovered, you know, this free speech riots of 1909. I think I was in my newspaper morgue looking up Tom Foley or something, and I came across Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's file. And it was just amazing to me that this moment had occurred, and as a kid who grew up in a working class family, a union family, it seemed like this moment of kind of pure idealism at the beginning of the labor movement. And, you know, in a character like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, this labor activist, this 19-year-old pregnant labor activist who 10 years before the right to vote was challenging brutal police and you know, the establishment of this Western town. I just thought this felt like, you know, an amazing story. And I kind of stewed over it for years until it started feeling more and more contemporary and decided I wanted to write a novel about it.
In the novel, we see the city through many different eyes. Early on, you write about Spokane. It was a boom town that just kept booming, doubling in size every 6 years, going from a few hundred to a hundred some thousand in just 30 years, until the only place bigger in the state was that ugly harbor blight, Seattle. Spokane felt like the intersection of frontier and civilized, both capitalized, and the final gasp of a thing before it turned into something else. What was fueling this growth in Spokane?
You have to think of that time, 1909, the railroad is like the internet is now. And so those places like Spokane, where seven main rail lines came together, you know, before they headed south to Portland in California, west to Seattle, north to Vancouver, Canada, and then to the east to Chicago, Minneapolis. It was a place where everything sort of squeezed together, and you had the incredibly rich mining of northern Idaho and western Montana. You had the timber, which was, of course, exploding as the country is building itself. And then you had agriculture, and those things all came together to create vast wealth. And because all those rail lines came together, and in 1909 there was a huge economic disaster that sort of presaged the Great Depression, you also had these transient workers, these hobos, thousands of whom would jump off trains and use Spokane as their as the place to find work. And those forces coming together created, you know, at the end of the last Gilded Age, when we had income inequality that matches what we have today, they created this tinder of class warfare that erupted in 1909.
Yeah, this is this collision of workers' rights and yeah. then the desire of these businessmen to fill their coffers. And it's interesting, as we read in the book, the tycoons don't just own the mines and the fields, they own the bars and the theaters and the hotels, and yeah. everybody seems to be on their payroll, including the cops. So what is all that consolidation of wealth and power? How did that help stoke the labor movement in this particular city?
You know, I think it was the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, were about 4 or 5 years old and had really started as more of an idea than a going concern. But they found a kind of willing audience in these vagrant workers, and they sent their organizers out west to organize them. And in Missoula and Spokane and Fresno, the cities outlawed speaking on the streets. No more than 3 people could gather. Such a clear violation of civil rights and of the right to free speech that the IWW organized these free speech riots. And there was great wealth. And more than that, there was an industry that was built to keep these workers in place, to use them through harvest and then to beat them and drive them out of town. And the wealthy mine owners and the men who owned the timber mills, you know, that their money often went to Pinkertons and other detective agencies whose job it was to infiltrate the unions and bust them up. And it was part of a larger labor war that went on through the 1890s until about 1913, you know, that erupted several times in violence, usually in the West. And it was, it was an amazing period. And again, for a nonfiction writer, I thought, oh, this would make such a good book. For a novelist, I thought, what a great backdrop to tell the story of how people get swept up in those kinds of moments.
My guest is Jess Walter. The name of his new novel is The Cold Millions. So you mentioned that free speech day. It's how the novel begins. The Wobblies have this free speech day. What was actually the goal of those days? Was it to get under the skin? Was it to get more people for the cause? Was it to raise money? What was the purpose?
I mean, I think the protests initially were, to bring attention to those things. Very much like protests today, I think mm-hmm. it's all those things, you know, increase the numbers in the IWW. But the Wobblies were a very specific organization. They were a singing union. They had their tradition goes back to a kind of folk Americana, and they would sing songs about being on the bum, and they would dress all in red sometimes, and so they would give speeches. They were nonviolent in every way, and so these were some of the first nonviolent protests in American history. And what they really wanted to do was sing, draw attention to themselves, and usually get arrested. And they're the only weapon they had there. This is a union made up largely of indigents and of, floating workers. And so the only weapon they felt like they had was their bodies. And they would sing until they were arrested, thrown in jail. And then they would keep singing until the jailers got tired of their songs and turn them loose. And this had worked in Missoula, but in Spokane, the powers that be decided to draw a line in the sand, and they were increasingly violent with the IWW, arresting more than 500 people, closing a school and filling it with workers, putting them on rock piles, often beating them, packing them in a steam room cell with more than 25 people in a 10-by-10 space.
Yeah, can I actually read that
brutality
section?
Can
I read that section?
Because sure.
It's one of the ones that really jumps out. So Rye, who we'll meet, we'll talk about him a little bit. He's about 16 years old when this happens, and they're about to all be thrown in jail. This large number of people that Jess was talking about. And you write, it's on page 55. Rye couldn't believe it when the jailer with glasses put a key in the cell door and unlocked it. He meant to put them in there? Where? Another jailer jabbed at the wall of bums with his nightstick and gestured at Rye and the others to go in. You wobs wanted to pack the jail. Here you go. Rye was pushed inside and pressed between 3 men, the stench bringing tears to his eyes. There were no sounds but breathing and moaning, and minutes seemed to take hours. At some point, 3 more men were shoved into the cell, then 2 more. 26, the jailer said proudly. but inside was a mass fever. The bulb went out, and it was a windowless basement, dark, the pipe hissing steam all night, the smell of vomit, time measured in pain and stench and thirst. Then someone would snap, and the others would subdue him, for the struggle hurt them all, knees and elbows and fists in rising panic. Then the basement door opened and a bit of stairwell light flooded in, men crying out that they had to use the bathroom or were sick. But two cops and two jailers clopped down on the stairs, drunk and laughing. "We're going for a record," one said, and two more wobblies were somehow jammed into the cell. Cops and jailers throwing their full weight against the door just to get it closed on the crush of men. Rye mashed between stinking flesh and iron bar, and all around him whimpering and moaning and gulping as if they were drowning in rotten flesh. And someone near him passed out, but the man just hung there between the bodies, nowhere to fall. It was, that's beautiful writing. Were the conditions this bad for real?
Yeah, I mean, most of what happens to the characters in the novel, especially in the free speech riots, comes from actual, you know, testimony and tales from that time. And so, yeah, they really did pack the first 3 days. They really did pack more than 20 in an 8x7 foot cell. And again, they thought they were teaching these out of town ruffians a lesson. But the wobblies just kept coming. You know, they would, for days and days afterward, they turned fire hoses on them. They dragged them to the end of town and beat them. And still, these protesters kept coming, and until finally Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who, while not the protagonist of the novel, is kind of the hero, this real labor activist, showed up, and it was really her arrest that kind of changed things. You know, I think at the time, you know, just the idea that the police would be as tough with this young apple-cheeked woman, I think, really turned the tide of public perception in Spokane.
My guest is Jess Walter. The name of his novel is The Cold Millions. Let's talk about some of the characters without giving too much away. You've mentioned Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. If anybody heads over and Googles her name, you'll learn she was one of the founders of the ACLU. She became chairwoman of the Communist Party. And she's 19 when we meet her. It's 10 years before the 19th Amendment was passed. And she's just on fire all the time about everything. And she's this incredible orator. And I read somewhere, I heard you say somewhere, that you were somewhat inspired by the young activists of today, like the Parkland kids.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was interesting working on this novel. One of the first things that drew me to it was income inequality. But I didn't want to write something didactic. And the more I looked at this period, I felt like this was a period that so mirrored our own in the way that civil unrest and income inequality and these things, you know, that bubbled up, that I started looking around at many of the young activists now, the Parkland shooting survivors, you know, asking for basic gun laws, mm-hmm. And students walking out of schools for climate change. And then this past summer, of course, the Black Lives Matter activists. And that sort of leading edge of activism, I just kept asking myself, you know, how is this affected? How does the passion of young people translate into the way the culture changes? And Elizabeth Gurley Flynn seemed like, you know, such an interesting part of that equation. 19 and pregnant and traveling the West alone, you know, to these rough labor camps and these cities that were like Spokane on the border between frontier and civilized, these, you know, dangerous places where the police were often involved in the brothels and, you know, it was not a place for the faint of heart, certainly. And here she was sort of, you know, riding into town. I always sort of envisioned this as a Western, and I thought in a way this was my Clint Eastwood stranger riding into town, you know, this woman, who was so irrepressible and with her energy.
The other young person in the novel is Rye, who, when I read that passage, was just getting thrown in jail. He's 16 when we meet him. He's a lot more innocent than his brother, Gig. What do we get by seeing the world through Rye's eyes? We follow him for a lot of the book.
Yeah, you know, I chose these two brothers. I wanted very much, as I said, for it to be a novel about young people. I didn't want to get into a debate about someone, whether or not, you know, the way communism had led to autocratic, brutal regimes in the Soviet Union and China meant that the philosophy was flawed. I wanted to go back to that moment of idealism when you're young and the youthful idealism of the labor movement. I wanted to be mirrored by these characters. And it really is a kind of coming-of-age story for Rye. Unlike his brother, who is a committed member of the IWW, although a bit of an autodidact and self-taught in every way, Gig is very much, you know, part of this movement. Rye is much more cautious and quiet. Maybe like a lot of us, he would go to the march but not be in front, and unsure that, you know, that this is going to be effective, this thing they're doing. And so I loved the sort of interplay between those two brothers. And as often happens when you write a novel, you don't really know the characters until you're partway through it, and then they start to emerge in this way. And that question that sort of hangs between the two of them, you know, between the passion of activism and the more quiet support of those people on the sidelines was something that I think really kind of created both the tension in the novel and allowed the characters to grow into who they were, especially Rye.
The characters each have sort of unique characters have characteristics. There you go, Allison. One of the characteristics of Gig, which is interesting, is he fancies himself well-read. And he carries around volumes 1 and 3 of War and Peace out of the 5-volume set. Why is this important to him?
As I was researching this period, and both of my grandfathers were itinerant workers in the 30s, and my grandpa Jess, whom I'm named after, was a rancher, and he would tell these wild stories of jumping on trains. As a kid, it sounded like stowing away on a pirate ship. It sounded so romantic. And I wanted to give a character sort of that sense of adventure that I felt hearing those stories. And then Gig has a quality I have. I'm a first-generation college student, first male in my direct line to graduate from high school. And so for me, books were a kind of social escalator, the only path I had to even the middle class, let alone aspiring beyond that. And so some of my favorite scenes in the book take place in libraries. And yet I have a bit of the autodidact in me too. And in my 20s, I wasn't above pronouncing something that I'd only read 40% of the greatest work of literature of all time. And I loved in my research finding that there was what was called the Great Hobo Highway. The more learned transient men would carry in their packs a book, and then they would trade it. I'll give you, you know, this Jack London for your Flaubert. And in this way, they would read their way across the country, swapping books. And again, it felt like such a great romantic detail. And you know, giving Gig a love for books, even though he has not had a great education, my class sympathies and romanticism mm-hmm. show sometimes. And, you know, I come from my sister's a librarian, my brother's a newspaper sports editor, and, you know, for a first generation of college students, words were the way we aspired our way up. And so I really wanted to give that to Gig as well.
The other sort of predominant female character is called Ursula the Great. She's a performer yeah. whose act ends with her singing to a cougar in a cage while wearing nothing but a corset, with a very detailed explanation of how she survives that. And, you know, yeah. for her beauty is powerful, but she knows that's not enough and that it's a depreciating asset. Yeah. So she sort of figures out a way to protect herself in several ways. What does she understand about power and wealth that some of the other characters may not?
Yeah, it was really important to me that if I was going to have Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's irrepressible energy and her fire and her, you know, unwillingness to bend to the rules of the time, that I also have a character who had to live in that world and had to navigate it. And Ursula the Great is a vaudeville singer. I was so taken by all of the amazing vaudeville acts that I came across during that time that filled some of the lesser theaters in Spokane, which was, strangely enough, one of the theater capitals of the West, maybe next to San Francisco. It was the most desirable place for entertainers to travel. And so Ursula, in navigating that whole world, has had to figure out, you know, how to take the attention of men and turn it into her own sort of parachute, you know, and she became one of my favorite characters. The novel is run through with, even though it's third person, with these first person stories, these characters who come on and sort of narrate their own bit of the story. And writing Ursula, she was just one of those characters that, as a fiction writer, you're lucky to discover. She marches on the stage and just starts telling you, and that's such a great thrill when that happens. And for me, she was, you know, the sort of character who will find a way to survive no matter what, and that is no mean feat in the world that she lives in.
My guest is Jess Walter. We're talking about his book, The Cold Millions, his new novel. We've only got a few minutes left, so let me see what I can squeeze in. I think it's important to talk about xenophobia and its role in this era. Specifically, what is it that you wanted us to understand about xenophobia then and maybe xenophobia now?
You know, in the early 1900s, there are all sorts of groups that are demonized by the nativists, might be, you know, Slav workers or, you know, people from the Balkans or what they call gypsies, and then of course the way Native American workers are treated and African American workers, it was in many ways very recognizable for people today, you know, to have a president who launched his campaign by descending an escalator to say that Mexicans were criminals and rapists. Again, the echoes of today were sort of all over the world then. And it really is why the sort of egalitarian views of the IWW drew me in. That sort of idealism to me also transcends time. And at a time when a lot of us, I think, are cynical, I found great hope in imagining that the classes could transcend race and immigration and those kinds of things and find themselves once again with common purpose to lift everyone. And that really was where I started the novel and kind of where I ended it, with those ideas.
Before I let you go, could you share a couple of Easter eggs in this novel that are a wink to today?
Sure. Yeah, there were, you know, when I think of myself as a journalist and a contemporary novelist, so writing about 1909, I always felt like I had one eye trained on the present. And so when I came up with the two brothers' names, I thought, Gregory and Rye, and their names will be Gig and Rye. And it felt like such a Rye nod to the gig economy, you know, that the Uber driver isn't very much, you know, who has to provide his own car isn't very much different than the Sawyer who went from camp to camp with his own saw, you know, that we are in some ways back there. When I realized that Ursula was going to dance on stage with a mountain lion and have a fondness for young, attractive men, I sort of laughed at myself that it would be a cougar she was dancing with. And so it's interesting to be conversant in 1909 and to be fluent in that language. But then you also feel like you want to translate it for readers now. And I've always loved sort of embedding work in my novel, literary and just other nods to culture. The novel has four sections and an epilogue, just like War and Peace. And as I'm writing, I'm often thinking of ways to almost transcend the text and have those kinds of ideas that to me sort of float above it.
That was Jess Walter talking to us about his novel, The Cold Millions, which is just out in paperback. And listeners, in case you haven't heard, we want to give you a breaking news update. There has been a not guilty verdict on all counts in the case of Kyle Rittenhouse, the 18-year-old who at 17 traveled over state lines and fatally shot two people in Kenosha, Wisconsin during a Black Lives Matter protest against the police shooting of Jacob Blake. On the fourth day of deliberations, the jury returned not guilty on a first-degree intentional homicide and four other charges. Kyle Rittenhouse had claimed self-defense. This is a developing story, and our colleagues at NPR will have updates at the top of the hour. This is All of It.